Shrink Wrap Radio number 57, The Power of Forgiveness, October 28, 2006. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
What a lot of people's questions are statements designed to get me to agree with them that their particular wound is not one that should be easily given up. So I often go to people and they ask me, well, what do you do about Hitler? And the implication of that is, since the world has Hitlers in it, you shouldn't push me too hard to not hate my mother-in-law.
That was the voice of Dr. Frederick Luskin, whose forgiveness training methodology has been validated through 6 successful research studies conducted through the Stanford Forgiveness Project. He's also the author of 2 books, Forgive for Good, and Stress-Free for Good, with co-author Dr. Kenneth Pelletier. Prior to the current surge of research interest, the importance of practicing forgiveness was extolled in both religious and psychological traditions. Recently, Dr. Luskin's and others' research has confirmed its virtues in the promotion of psychological, relationship, and physical health. Forgiveness has been shown to reduce anger, hurt, depression, and stress, and to lead to greater feelings of optimism, hope, compassion, and self-confidence. Dr. Luskin holds a PhD in counseling and health psychology from Stanford University. He's the co-director of the Stanford Northern Ireland Hope Project, an ongoing series of workshops and research projects that investigates the effectiveness of his forgiveness methods on the victims of political violence. He served as the director of the Stanford Forgiveness Project, the largest research project to date on the training and measurement of a forgiveness intervention. He currently works as a senior fellow at the Stanford Center on Conflict and Negotiation and is also on the faculty at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology in Palo Alto, California. Dr. Luskin presents lectures, workshops, seminars, and trainings throughout the United States on the importance, health benefits, and the training of forgiveness. To forgive may be divine, according to Alexander Pope, but it's hardly easy. How do you forgive a hit-and-run driver, a boss who makes life unbearable, or a cheating spouse? Luskin says not only can you forgive such people, but that for your own mental and physical health, you must. He's careful to make the distinction between forgiveness and condoning actions, forgetting them, or reconciling them with the offender, all or some of which may not be possible. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Fred Luskin, thanks so much for agreeing to be my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio. Let's start out with your Stanford affiliation. What's your role there, past and present?
I mean, years ago, I was a full-time researcher in the medical school, and now I still am doing a little bit of research with them, and I teach forgiveness classes for their continuing studies department and for the hospital.
Okay.
For the Stanford Hospital.
Okay, and you also did your doctoral work there, right?
I did. I got a PhD there.
Yeah, great. And now I think you're also working at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology in Palo Alto?
Yes. I teach clinical assessment. I teach therapists how to do projective and cognitive kind of assessment.
Okay. I remember when I used to go through that kind of training myself. It's been a long time.
way back when, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've done some fascinating research on the healing power of forgiveness.
That's true.
And a quality such as forgiveness seems like such a soft and intangible thing. How did you go about researching it?
Well, when I started, it was simply to make one of the virtues or one of the, like, the positive qualities, just to offer a little bit of proof. Proof is too strong, that it was true. That it was true not just on a kind of faith-based or intangible level, but a pragmatic level as well. And I wanted to show that it was not that complicated to show that if you taught people one of these, like forgiveness or hope or charity or whatever, that you could show improvements in psychological and physical and even relationship health.
Okay, so how did you go about researching something like forgiveness? Maybe you can describe the setup a little bit.
Well, I mean, I didn't research forgiveness so much. I took people who were hurt and developed a forgiveness training that I gave to them and
okay.
then measured the change.
Okay. And
so, I mean, I'm not that interested. I mean, you know, when I was going through this and my dissertation advisor told me that like 80% of all psychological research, you know, doesn't do anything to anybody. It just correlates one set of variables with another.
Yeah.
Like, I found that really kind of pathetic.
Right.
That if that was really 80% of what the research was, you know, this person's 6 feet tall and he has 12 ribbits of this, and this person's 5'6" and they have 12 ribbits of that, then what is the relationship? And that just seemed like a total waste.
Well, were your findings different than that sort of research?
I did outcome studies. I mean, that's all we've done is outcome studies. We mm-hmm. have taken people in various levels of pain from different things and taught them about forgiveness and shown that it makes them either have less blood pressure or more energy or things like that.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, take us through some of those findings, like blood pressure, that's a good one, energy.
Well, blood pressure was one specific study done at the University of Florida Hospital, but another one was we took Stanford students, the first one, and able to show that it reduced, you know, stress and anger. And a further study that we did was with premenopausal women, and you could show that it reduced their stress. And we did a few studies with men and women who had like family members murdered, and could show the effect of that. So what the purpose was and the outcome is, to me, really a duh, that if you're not so angry and you're actually, you know, if you actually resolve the antagonism in a beneficent way, which is, gee, this is not that complicated, that it's going to cause less stress to your body and less negative impact in your life.
I think a lot of the findings of psychology come across to lay people as, duh, didn't we know that already?
I wish psychology did more practical things like that. I mean, there was some analysis done of like all the psychological research. If they looked at all the journals and the psychologists and the psychiatrists things, and they showed that for every article on any kind of positive human quality, there were 17 on a negative human quality. So for every article on love or compassion or mercy or kindness, there were equivalent of 17 on hatred or, you know, anger or stress or all those things. And I don't know how helpful that is to human beings.
Right. I don't think it's very hopeful at all. And, of course, it's that kind of observation that gave rise both to humanistic and transpersonal psychology and more recently positive psychology.
And the only thing, you know, that I did was just try to take some of this material that has been used forever and just show with very simple pre-post follow-up and, you know, a useful control group that these very simple practices that had been, you know, since time immemorial, you could show that they did have an effect. And I found it very embarrassing that the field that I was in had waited till 2000 to even begin to show that.
Mm-hmm. So how did you come to this work in the first place? Was there something in your personal life that brought you to it?
I mean, I came to the work because of two things. One, I had to come up with a dissertation. This was my PhD dissertation at first.
Right.
And two, I had had a very long-standing spiritual practice and saw that the question was not like how angry you are, but how kind you are. That was what measured you as a person. And it was very different to say I'm angry or less angry than it is to say I'm a loving or kind person, and how much. They were not the same metric, and this field was missing discussion of the more positive metric. It just was obsessed with people's wounds and people's hurts and their negativity and all their grouchy negative ways of dealing with it.
Yeah. And forgiven.
It seemed that we had caused ourselves to be, say, the high priests of dysfunction.
That's not a role I would aspire to.
The only thing I can say is that I had been hurt, and I had to figure out how to get over somebody who had hurt me.
Mm-hmm.
And I used some of that in the methodology.
Mm-hmm.
But it was more that, honestly, I benefited from having an absolutely neglected area of human experience. So it's not that I did such great research. It's not that I was even so brilliant. It's just that nobody had gone there.
Yeah. Is that incident where you were hurt and you had to get through that, is that a story that you can share?
Oh, I've shared that a lot of times. It's even in the book that I wrote. What happened to me, I had a very close friend who stopped being a friend of mine, and I had no understanding of why, and at that point, no resources to absorb it.
Yeah, that can be very hurtful. So how did you work with yourself on that?
Well, I did the stuff that became the Forgiveness Project. It took me a long time to get there, but I realized that, this was my problem and not his, and B, that it was an absolutely idiotic way to look at life. But this did take me years as to what was wrong with my life rather than what was right with my life. And I brought my meditation practice into moment-to-moment stress management practice.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't mean that much to sit and meditate for a half hour twice a day if it didn't have an impact on your minute-to-minute functioning. And I started to see that was really missing in the therapeutic utilization of stress management, that what you really needed was, say, a 15-second break from your own negativity through peacefulness, and then your mind could reset and give you some choice.
Okay. You mentioned meditation. Are you in the Buddhist tradition, or how would you just...
Myself, personally, I have followed Self-Realization Fellowship, which is the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda.
Oh, yes, I'm familiar with that. And, go ahead.
No, but the Buddhist theory is certainly as good as any. It's just the specific path I have followed was a more yoga-based path.
Yes, yeah. And, since we're on the topic of spirituality, a couple of my guests have mentioned the Course in Miracles as having influenced them. For example, Norman Shealy, who spoke on longevity, and Jerry Jampolsky, who spoke on attitudinal healing. Have you had any contact with the Course in Miracles?
I've seen it. When I looked at it, it looked way too cumbersome when I looked at it first. And the book, say Jerry Jampolsky's book, Love is Letting Go of Fear, was a useful book, and some of Marianne Williamson's stuff. But I was, the truthful thing is that when I was looking to teach this, I made it into a secular training.
Uh-huh. I think that's probably important.
The Course in Miracles was based too strongly for me on kind of spiritual or even religious kind of values. And now when I teach, I do adhere more. I do have some Buddhist ideas in what I teach, and some Hindu-based ideas, because they are not deity-based.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I would think that would really, really be important to unhook.
If you want people to listen.
Yes.
The other thing, I don't know how, you'll probably find this interesting, is when we first started, we had some questions as to whether a religious-based approach would be helpful, until we found just how deeply acrimonious religious people are, that many of them, not all, were so embedded in their own particular faith that they missed the purpose of what I saw as their faith. So I would go into places and I'd have people tell me, you know, this would be really good if you mentioned Jesus. And then I'd have somebody else tell me this was good, but, you know, Buddhist loving kindness practice is better. And it seemed at that point very prudent to just stay away from it entirely.
Okay. Now, you do a lot of public speaking, and I've been on your website. I see you do a lot of...
I do a lot of public speaking. What I still do is a number of classes where mm-hmm. I teach this to other people.
Right. That's what I saw, were a lot of workshop trainings, which looked like they'd be very good. What kinds of questions do you tend to hear from people most when you do that?
What a lot of people's questions are statements designed to get me to agree with them that their particular wound is not one that should be easily given up.
Uh-huh.
So I often go to people and they ask me, well, what do you do about Hitler? And the implication of that is, since the world has Hitlers in it, you shouldn't push me too hard to not hate my mother-in-law. That people will say, well, how could you possibly get over a betrayal by somebody really close to you like that? That has to push the envelope. And that'll be because it was their husband who betrayed them. And somebody else will say to me, you know what's really hard, and I'm wondering if you really believe it fully for this, is, you know, how do I get over somebody I don't know? I could understand if it was somebody who knew me, because at least I have a relationship, but how do I possibly get over a hit-and-run driver who doesn't know me at all? And most people's questions, I mean, I think this is true of all the religious doubt we have, are based to some degree to find a loophole for what it is that we want to know is true but can't live.
Mm-hmm. I know you've worked with people who are struggling with really big issues that are hard to forgive. For example, a loved one who's been murdered, or a cheating spouse. And yet you've had success.
One of the first projects we did a number of years ago was, we invited mothers from both sides of the conflict in Northern Ireland who had had their sons shot to come together to Stanford and learn to forgive. So we had Catholic and Protestant mothers in a room with us for a week, teaching them about forgiveness. Recently, I did some work with family members whose, you know, loved ones were killed at the attacks at the World Trade Center.
That sounds courageous of you to take that on. How has that work gone?
It's not courageous as much as it's painful for me to see all the ways that people maintain their hostility at life because of what life has done to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see it anymore most of the time as the seriousness of the provocation, but as just this unbelievable need human beings have to strike back at each other.
Mm-hmm. And we have
And I have seen red-faced hatred all over the San Francisco Bay Area for people who don't like George Bush.
Right.
And they have the same self-righteous, high blood pressure hostility as somebody who tells me that their ex-husband isn't paying child support. And I see the exact same consciousness and the exact same need to demonize somebody that they don't like what they're doing.
So what do you say to, you know, people get particularly self-righteous around these political convictions. How do you deal with that? I know exactly what you're talking about. I remember...
It's sometimes what I say, but I'm struck because we live in such a left-leaning area. And then I go to other parts of the country which are significantly more right-leaning, and it just appears that people whose identification is hard towards one side, they maintain it by disliking the people who are hard towards the other side. That tension keeps them in a very narrow band, which may make them feel safer on this planet because they know who their enemies are. At least they make believe they know who their enemies are, because they don't see the enemy within themselves, mm-hmm. which creates such hostility.
Yeah, for me this resonates a lot with Jung's idea of the shadow and the way that we project our own shadow on other people.
Yeah, because, I mean, so what do I say? I mean, I say that, I mean, honestly, when I'm around here, I say that if we who live in the San Francisco Bay Area, who have every advantage known to humankind, can't be kind with people we disagree with, then the world has very little hope.
Mm-hmm.
And with all this education and all this luxury and all this affluence and all this beauty, if that's not enough to make us gracious, then, first of all, there's no them out there causing this world's pain. It's us. And I don't have that much hope. I mean, at that level of consciousness. And that's how I see it. That all of us who live the way we live, probably if we were more attuned to the way things are, would want to give more rather than needing more to be our way before we're happy and kind.
Okay. And have you had any experience taking this work to businesses?
Have I made this experiences in businesses?
Yeah. Have you taken this work at all?
Yes, we have. In fact, we've been doing a long-running, quite successful research project at American Express where we've taught financial service advisors about forgiveness and that and stress management as being cornerstones of emotional competence. And we teach them how to do this. We do some follow-up coaching on phones. And we've been able to show significant increases in sales and significant decreases in stress over a year of working with people. And we're on our sixth year of this now.
Mm-hmm. I can see where stress reduction fits into that. What about forgiveness? I mean, what is there to forgive in the world of business?
Well, this started, honestly, after the stock market crash of 2000. But that's where this began. We were invited into one of the market groups of American Express to do some forgiveness work with advisors who had just lost money and whose clients hated them.
Wow, yeah.
But now, forgiveness is just so it's obvious to me that there's so much to forgive in this life. It's almost unimaginable, but we don't even notice all the ways that we're triggered. So in a business sense, if your computer breaks, that's a forgiveness moment. If your secretary loses something, that's a forgiveness moment. If you fail to do something properly, that's a forgiveness moment. And they're omnipresent. And the more grace one can bring to all of those moments, the more productive one will be.
Mm-hmm. And do you find people in the world of business being receptive to this message?
I wouldn't say globally, but we've made a niche now in American Express because we're on our, I think, seventh project or eighth project, and it's starting to spread. So it's starting to spread within that company. Often when I go talk about this, even the stress management piece has many business people's eyes glaze over. And the idea of emotional competence being helpful, they just don't resonate to that. I see a lot of business people are not that concerned with the emotional well-being of their staff.
Mm-hmm.
They just want them to be productive.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly the stereotype that many people have about business.
I don't think that's untrue.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the condition of the world, it's the brutality that people do to other people to extract more money from them is staggering.
So I hear two things then. I hear, in fact, that you see that and that it's upsetting. And at the same time, I hear you saying that that you're working at forgiveness.
Yeah, the whole thing.
It's a bit paradoxical, right?
What's that?
I say maybe it's a bit paradoxical.
The forgiveness is our attitude.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that you stop, you know, pushing whatever it is that your own peculiar agenda is. You just have to do it with a little more lightness and maybe less demonization, but we're all gifted with something to make this world better in an omnipresent way.
Yeah.
You know, this is the history and the constant status of our planet, and it never changes, and each of us is challenged within that to see it, not become bitter, not try to make that the way oneself operates, and see what one can do to help.
Right, right.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. It definitely makes sense to me.
I mean, that's just every generation, every country, every inch of this planet is filled with relentless suffering and unkindness.
Yeah. In terms of your own professional work, your interest, your research, where's your growing edge right now?
I think for the first time now, I'm just starting two edges. One is I'm just starting to teach people to teach this. So I'm developing a handful of people who can also teach what I teach.
Mm-hmm.
And for the first time, I'm really getting an opportunity to work with a lot of therapists that for a number of years, therapists were a little intimidated by the idea of forgiveness, and then the positive psychology movement came in and changed the whole face of everything, and now I'm getting invited to do trainings all over the place for therapists.
That's an interesting development.
Yeah, because I used to get a lot of harsh response from therapists, and not anymore.
Well, I think, you know, for a long time, the dominant view in therapy, probably coming out of a Freudian history, was sort of what's been called the ventilationist approach, you know, where you kind of get your anger out and you express a lot of anger. And I think sometimes people kind of got stuck in that mode.
That would be something I would say.
Mm-hmm.
But tomorrow I'm flying to Santa Fe to do a training for, you know, 50 therapists, and I just came back from a therapist training, and I just did one in Marin a few weeks ago, and just for the first time, there's an openness that's really, to me, profound, because it shows me that Martin Seligman's work with positive psychology may be a seminal opening in this field.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, that those of us in the humanistic transpersonal camp need to look at it that way. I have some friends in that camp who were very angry at first when he came out because he wasn't giving any acknowledgement to that history. But, hey, however it comes across, whatever it does to help keep people focused on these positive possibilities, then I say, you know, that's a good thing.
Like, don't you think we each have to realize that we've invented nothing?
Well, seriously,
don't we all have to understand that this isn't our planet, that we're guests here, that we have a very short lease, and we've invented nothing, that it's all been there and it's all been done before, and each generation picks it up and gets its chance to say it in its own way, and that's what we get.
That's very well put. I think any time we go back and we read ancient writings, we certainly are struck with that. Hey, there's this natural tendency, I think, to think that people who lived a long time ago and wrote a long time ago, that they didn't know as much as we know today. But then when you go back and actually read somebody from a long time ago, whether it's the Greeks or the Romans.
And some things we know less, like we couldn't live off the land the way some people did.
Yes.
But forgiveness. What does that mean? I mean, Jesus said to forgive when he's being crucified, and that was what 2,000 years ago. And it's been in every religion, and the transpersonal psychology developed nothing. I mean, they just took some qualities that were always been and tried to own them for psychology. I mean, I'm not putting it down, but none of this was new.
Yeah. Well, it must be really gratifying to you to have these opportunities opening up to introduce these ideas into the field of psychotherapy.
Gratifying is half of it. This has been for 10 years I've had opportunities that I don't think anybody else has had with forgiveness. Because my work came out of Stanford, that because I had the imprimatur of that enormous, powerful university, I got heard in a way that other people hadn't been heard. So I would be the first person on the Today Show, and you know what I'm saying? And the first person interviewed by the New York Times, and all those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been gratifying, but the other part of it has been sobering in the sense that I've really had to sit with how much unkindness, harshness, and horror there is on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
That if I'm honest, which when you see one hurt person after another, and everywhere you go, there's loss and change and pain, a lot of it from simple human unkindness, it's a big challenge to hold that, to see that clearly, and still understand that each of us needs to choose to love within that. That most of us try to love and make believe that doesn't exist, and we try to live in a kind of fantasy. But the deeper difficulty, and I believe the true spiritual path, is to look it in the eye and still choose to do kindness and whatever. That it's not a weak thing. It's a thing of great substance.
Mm. I really like the way you put all that.
I
really like the way you put all that. Do you have any tips for any listeners who might be struggling with forgiveness?
Well, if you go on my website, www.learningtoforgive.com,
mm-hmm.
there are my 9 steps of forgiveness are just listed there.
Yeah, and I think maybe, and I usually do a little post commentary after the interview, and I was thinking of actually going over those in my post interview commentary,
sure.
So people will get that
and
exposure.
And the book I wrote called Forgive for Good,
mm-hmm.
that's by far and away the biggest selling forgiveness book like that. So that book has helped, you know, tens of thousands of people.
Okay, well, I'll put a link to that in our show notes. As we wrap things up here, is there anything else that you'd like to say?
No, I was given media training maybe 5 years ago. I'll just laugh at that. And because I had to go on some TV show and they didn't trust me and I didn't know what I was doing. And I remember thinking, like, the person asked me to summarize what we had done.
Yeah.
And it still holds true that the news that we bring is that you can teach people to forgive, that it's a learned skill.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not esoteric and it doesn't have to be religious. It's simply a latent aspect of each human being, and that you can learn to uncover it and use it. And I think that's a very powerful message.
Indeed. You know, and I think one of the points that we didn't get to here, but that I believe is embedded in your work, is that in fact it does us harm, it's poisonous to us to carry resentment and lack of forgiveness.
That's the truth.
Okay. So, Dr. Fred Luskin, thanks so much for sharing with us here on Shrink Wrap Radio, and I wish you Godspeed in this work.
Hey, thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Fred Luskin. I was chatting about this interview with Jamie Nelson of the Dige Planet podcast, and he made a couple of interesting points. He reminded me of what a powerful living example of forgiveness we've all just witnessed in the Amish community. If you don't live in the U.S., you might not know about the incident I'm referring to, so let me just quickly recap it. The Amish are an Anabaptist Christian denomination found primarily in Pennsylvania in the U.S. and Ontario, Canada, and they're known for their restrictions on the use of modern devices such as automobiles and electricity, and also for their mode of dress. They dress very plainly, very simply. The women wear no makeup. They dress very conservatively, and they look like quaint pioneer people from the early American past. The Amish separate themselves from mainstream society for religious reasons. They don't join the military, they draw no social security, in fact they're exempted by law from paying social security taxes, nor do they accept any form of financial assistance from the government, and many avoid insurance. They mainly speak a German dialect known as Pennsylvania Dutch, and it's estimated that there are maybe 190,000 Amish living in the U.S. and Canada. I remember when I was a student at the University of Pennsylvania, and I would see them sometimes on back roads near York, Pennsylvania, in horses and buggies. Well, not in horses. Driving horse and buggy carts. Recently, a deranged man went on a rampage and shot 10 children in an Amish school before turning the gun on himself and committing suicide. In the aftermath of this tragedy, one Amish woman was quoted as saying, "We have to forgive. We have to forgive him in order for God to forgive us." Indeed, families of the slain children reached out to the family of the killer, who in fact are neighbors to the Amish community.
The papers reported that one Amish man said of the shooter's family, "I hope they stay around here, and they'll have lots of friends and a lot of support." Talk about turning the other cheek. Now that's real forgiveness. There would be a lot less violence on the planet if more people practice forgiveness rather than revenge. The other point that my friend Jamie made, which hadn't occurred to me during the interview, is that one of the biggest forgiveness challenges for many of us is to forgive ourselves. How much energy is tied up in self-hate, self-loathing, self-recrimination, and guilt? So as you ponder Dr. Luskin's thoughts on forgiveness, give some thought not only to the grudges against others that you might be hanging on to, but also the places where you might need to extend some forgiveness towards yourself. Now, here are the 9 steps to forgiveness that Dr. Luskin referred to in our talk. 1. Know exactly how you feel about what happened and be able to articulate what about the situation is not okay. Then tell a trusted couple of people about your experience. 2. Make a commitment to yourself to do what you have to do to feel better. Forgiveness is for you and not for anyone else. I think what he's talking about there is that when we hold a grudge, when we hold anger, it's actually toxic for us. It's hard on our bodies. It's hard on our immune system. And so that's what he means when he says forgiveness is for you, not for anyone else. It's a gift to yourself to forgive because you're letting go of this sort of inner clenching that's not going to do your health or your psyche any good. 3, forgiveness does not necessarily mean reconciliation with the person that hurt you or condoning of their action. What you are after is to find peace. Forgiveness can be defined as peace and understanding that come from blaming that which has hurt you less, taking the life experience less personally, and changing your grievance story. I think that's something that we've talked about in previous episodes. The stories that we tell ourselves shape the emotions that we experience. And we can either tell ourselves a victim story or not. 4, get the right perspective on what is happening. Recognize that your primary distress is coming from the hurt feelings, thoughts, and physical upset you are suffering now, not what offended you or hurt you 2 minutes or 10 minutes ago. Forgiveness helps to heal those hurt feelings. 5, at the moment you feel upset, practice a simple stress management technique to soothe your body's flight or fight response. 6, give up expecting things from other people or your life that they do not choose to give you. Recognize the unenforceable rules you have for your health or how you or other people must behave. Remind yourself that you can hope for health, love, peace, and prosperity and work hard to get them. 7, put your energy into looking for another way to get your positive goals met than through the experience that's hurt you. Instead of mentally replaying your hurt, seek out new ways to get what you want. 8, remember that a life well lived is your best revenge. Instead of focusing on your wounded feelings and thereby giving the person who caused you pain power over you, learn to look for the love, beauty, and kindness around you. Forgiveness is about personal power. And finally, 9, amend your grievance story to remind you of the heroic choice to forgive. And again, I refer to the Amish and what a heroic choice those families have made in forgiving the family that gave birth to the man who killed their children. Finally, here's a quote from Dr. Luskin's website. "The practice of forgiveness has been shown to reduce anger, hurt, depression, and stress, and leads to greater feelings of hope, peace, compassion, and self-confidence. Practicing forgiveness leads to healthy relationships as well as physical health. It also influences our attitude, which opens the heart to kindness, beauty, and love." And for those of you who are invested in scientific research, hey, he's done the science to back it up.
On the couch again with Dr. Dave and shrink wrap.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Hey, I want to thank each of you who's taken our listener survey. Right now we have 22 surveys that have been sent in, and I appreciate each and every one of those. They include a lot of valuable feedback and suggestions. At the very end of the survey, you have the option to include your name and email address. As an added incentive to get you all to fill out the survey, for everyone who completes the survey and includes their name and email address, I'm going to send you a link to some exclusive content. Some years back, I won't say how many, I gave a talk on dreams at the University of New Hampshire. It's just under an hour long with lots of questions and answers. I hadn't listened back to this in some time, and I have to say I'm favorably impressed. So if you'd like to access this special feature, go to our survey at shrinkwrapradio.com/survey.htm. And yes, I will also send the link to those of you who've already filled out the survey before this announcement. So far, I've only got 22 surveys in, but I'm happy to report that we have 237 pins on our Frapper map. Now, both of these numbers are but a fraction of our total listenership. So fill out those surveys and put yourself on our map. All you have to do to enter is go to frapper.com/shrinkwrapradio, or you'll find a link on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com. Plus, you'll be entered into a drawing for a free copy of a book I co-authored. Now, we do have 4 new additions to our Frapper map, and I want to give a big thank you and a welcome to Nathaniel in Santa Cruz, California, Frank in Ontario, Canada, Sabrina in Winnipeg, Canada, and Atlanta in Sydney, Australia. In other news, I got a call yesterday from my friend and colleague, Dr. Susan Stewart, who you may recall from Shrink Wrap Radio number 9 on Mythic Views of Aging. Well, she's writing a book on this topic, and she called to ask me how she could go about registering a couple of domain names for her book. Of course, I told her I could get her a discount at GoDaddy.com, and she ended up buying 2 domain names for 2 years, having one point at the other, buying privacy protection for both, and also 2 years of web hosting. And by using the discount code SHRINK1, she saved 10% off the already low cost of her entire order. You'll find other GoDaddy discounts on our website at Shrink Wrap Radio. By the way, I don't know how you get Shrink Wrap Radio, but if you are not subscribed, please do so. It will ensure that you get the show regularly, and it also helps me do a better job of obtaining sponsors and tracking stats. Most listeners subscribe through iTunes. A good alternative is to use Juice, which is a free cross-platform software program. That's J-U-I-C-E, and you can find that link quickly using Google to search for Juice Podcast Software. And another good one is iPodder, which is also free, and both work on whatever platform you might happen to be using.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know. And just enough to make you dangerous.
Hey, thanks to Deborah Dean for that very sexy transition. Maybe it'll inspire others. Next, let's go to our listener email. And the first actually comes from an old friend, Jerry Trumbull, who you might recall from a couple of our early episodes. And it comes in the form of a voicemail.
Hello, Dr. Dave. This is Jerry Trumbull in Denver. As you know, I'm one of your avid listeners. And I just wanted to give you a little feedback on show number 55, in which you interviewed Dr. Amin regarding his use of the SPECT scan. And I have to admit, I was not familiar with that SPECT scan, S-P-E-C-T. And I found a site which I think might be of interest to your listeners called Brain Matters Inc., INC.com. Which fully explains the single photon emission computed tomography imaging devices. in diagnosis of behavioral problems. To me, of course, with a background in physiological psychology, what is now called cognitive science, it made a lot of sense to look at the brain activity as the source of problems in behavior. I think most of us would agree that the brain is the organ of behavior, and that if we only had the means to fully examine the brain, we could solve many of our current pathological problems, as well as gain greater understanding of how the brain actually works. Now, you know, because you know me personally, that I spent a lot of time back in the 60s using something called a stereotaxic instrument and lowering tiny wires into the brains of rats, trying to determine the activities in those areas without a whole lot of success. So back in the 60s, after a considerable amount of work, it dawned on me that until we were able to read the activity of specific neurons at a distance without surgical intervention, we weren't going to get very far in this brain exploration. It seems to me that Dr. Ammann's work with the SPECT scan is approaching that. Now, I recall that you had a source that made two objections to his work. One of the objections was that he should use a double-blind study to remove any biases that he might have in his own reading of the SPECT scans, and that, I think, could be easily arranged. And the other one was that the SPECT scan was a blunt instrument and not very well refined as to specific brain areas. Now, I think I would agree with both of those in that double-blind studies could be done. And yes, indeed, the SPECT scan is somewhat blunt, but compared to the intrusive lowering of wires into the brain, it's actually quite a refined instrument. And it seems to me that it's probably the best instrument available at this time. But the general position that we should look at the brain if we want to understand behavior seems to me to be, if you will, a no-brainer, excuse the pun. At any rate, I thought it was a great interview, and I'd like to hear more of that sort of interview in which the underlying activities of the brain are related to behavior. Not that I don't enjoy some of the other explorations that you do, because many of these are new areas to me. So keep up the good work, Dr. Dave. We're really enjoying it out here.
Jerry, thanks so much for that audio comment. You know how much I like to get audio comments, particularly such well-informed ones as that. And your comment makes me think that you and others might be interested in a story that I found in the newspaper just a couple of days ago. Let me read at least parts of it to you. It says, depression study finds brain clues, abnormalities found in brain region that regulates pleasure and reward. Research on depression has focused on the depths of low mood and negative thoughts that have come to define this common disabling condition. Now, a team of New York scientists has found that clinically depressed people may have abnormalities in a region of the brain that regulates pleasure and reward, and the finding could ultimately lead to novel ways to treat the disease. Dr. David Silberswag and his colleagues at Weill Cornell Medical Center brought 22 people into the research laboratory to undergo brain scans while watching words come up on a monitor. Some words were positive, some negative, and others neutral. The aim was to see if the depressed brain looked different in the region that governs reward when reading these words. The answer is yes. The scientists tested 10 depressed people who had not yet received treatment and 12 volunteers with no history of mental illness. One key characteristic of depression is that patients have a very hard time motivating themselves and enjoying things that once made them feel good. The brain scan measured blood oxygen changes in active brain regions. The color-coded statistical images allowed the researchers to determine which areas were most active in response to emotion-laden words. The scientists found that the brains of non-depressed volunteers responded differently to positive and negative words, particularly in an area called the ventral striatum, a key reward center of the brain. Positive words such as rejoice and success triggered more activity in this region than negative words such as damaged and useless, or the neutral words. By comparison, those with depression had decreased activity in this brain region when reading the positive words. Silberzweig said that this finding, published in the latest issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry, suggests that the reward area is not reacting to positive stimuli in depressed people. And the article goes on from there, but that's enough to get the idea across, and it certainly does dovetail well both with what you said, Jerry, and with the report that we heard from Dr. Amen. I was happy to receive an email from Alan, who writes, "Hello, Dr. Dave. I'm a first-year clinical PsyD student attending school in Los Angeles, California. I stumbled upon your podcasts and would like to tell you how much I'm enjoying them. I listen to them at home as well as in the car when I commute to school. I've listened to most of the podcasts, and they're very informative and entertaining to listen to." Hey, I'm so glad to hear that. Thanks a lot, Alan. He goes on to say, "I was wondering if you could suggest any other sites on the internet that have audio/visual multimedia regarding psychology. I'm new to this. I particularly enjoyed the Gestalt podcast because we've been discussing that in my lectures, and we just viewed a tape the other day of Fritz Perls in action. Thank you very much, and keep up the good work. Sincerely, Alan." Alan, I think I have mentioned maybe in an email reply to you and maybe on the show before, there is an excellent podcast that comes from Australia called All in the Mind. It's put out by the Australian Public Broadcasting Company, and so it's very polished and professional. Next, we hear from Chris, who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, firstly, let me say how much I appreciate your show. I'm a midlife student of couple counseling doing a post-grad dip in England with Relate. Relate is one of the largest relationship counseling organizations in the world, with, I believe, a couple of thousand counselors in the UK. I've been listening for about 6 months now. I'm also interested in film, to be specific, links between film script, structure, and a film's success. There seems to be many similarities between the standard 3X structure and what we do with our clients in this fascinating work. I would like to eventually do research in this area, in particular connecting it to my previous life in software and its potential as therapeutically interactive film. I'd love to email Dr. Tui Wilczynski to see if he has any reading suggestions or other interests, and in particular hoping for a peek at his work." And Chris, as you know, I did email you contact info for getting in touch with Tui. "Hopefully this will make you feel okay about putting me in touch with him. Keep up the really valuable work. Kind regards, Chris." Hey, Chris, you know, I just read an article in the current issue of The New Yorker that's written by Malcolm Gladwell, and it's about neural network software that, using movie plot elements, is able to predict which movies will be blockbusters and which ones won't. You really should look that up in the New Yorker magazine. I also got a nice long email comment about some of my remarks on hypnotherapy from Tom, who's a psychology student in Melbourne, Australia. But I think I'm going to hold off response to that email for the next show, and I'll read it then. Okay, I think this is a good place for us to wrap things up for now. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, and you can leave voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod, and alternatively, you're encouraged to leave voice messages on MyChingo. And you'll find a link to that on our Shrink Wrap Radio website, or you can just send us an MP3 file. Please help us grow our audience by spreading the word about Shrink Wrap Radio to your friends and your colleagues. And if you have a podcast or a blog or a MySpace or a LinkedIn page, give us a plug there if you would. I want to thank in particular Carl Grasso, who has a blog called growlydidge.com, and Nathaniel Jacobson, who has a blog called MarketWatch, and Simon Young with his blog Leadership Issues, and Dave Bondi with Bondi Blog. And I want to thank each of you for the great plugs you've given Shrink Wrap Radio in the recent past, and I'd like to encourage others out there to do the same. Don't forget to take that listener survey at shrinkwrapradio.com/survey.htm. Thanks again to our guest, Dr. Fred Luskin, for the interview. And I want to let you know that my next guest will be Dr. Suzanne Lovell, who directs a graduate program on art therapy. She's a wise woman whose words you will not want to miss. We close with a piece of PodSafe music, which seems particularly appropriate for our interview with Dr. Luskin. It's called Forgive Me by Cofield Mundi from Cape Town, South Africa. You'll find a link to this tune in our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
With me in my heart and in my mind's eye, just one thing I've got to say, now that it's over, forgive me for everything I've done, forgive me. I don't run from you, I just only